Welcome to Transparent VC by Tribe Global Ventures, the B2B VC. This week's founder focus guest is Susanna George, founder of UrbanList. UrbanList is a compass for those who live like it matters and provides trusted recommendations in areas such as food and drink, entertainment, style, health, and even pets. Their trusted tips power billions in annual spend, serving 30,000 recommendations across Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore every hour. UrbanList was named Australian Media Brand of the Year in 2021 and 2023, and you'll soon see why. Susanna shares her early journey into entrepreneurship, going to work with her father in the family business in Bundaberg, then finishing university and heading overseas to Paris, LA, and she shares how these experiences created the foundations for launching UrbanList. This episode is not just interesting lessons and stories, but Susanna shares some really actionable ideas that founders can use to scale their own businesses. Susanna shares a framework she uses to create a culture and an environment that supports finding the right people and the organizational ingredients to bring them together to achieve their ambitious vision and mission. This episode is also a masterclass in finding early product market fit and the goals Susanna used when setting out to confirm if she was on the right path or not. Susanna provides great insights into content marketing and customer acquisition strategies and walks through content creation that drives action. Susanna shares that it took 10 years to figure out her operating system and how to make each interconnected flywheel spin faster. And there's a lot in here that we think founders can walk away with in terms of their own journey. So we hope you enjoy it as much as we did making it. And as always, we welcome any comments and feedback.
Welcome to the Transparent Tribe Global podcast. Thank you for coming on. We've been trying to get you on forever. So this is exciting.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
We absolutely want to dive into the genesis story of UrbanList, but would love actually to hear a bit about your background before UrbanList, because I know you very well and I know that is such an interesting path and interesting journey. So insofar as you'd be prepared to talk about that, I would love to hear what you did from school onwards.
All right. May I open by acknowledging the traditional custodians? Something that is really important as part of my belief system and our culture. And so for me today, I'm in what's now known as Sydney, and it's the Gadigal of Eora. And I want to pay tribute to the immense contribution to the culture that we experience today that they have generously gifted us with, and acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hear, hear.
So I grew up in Bundaberg. So I might take us preschool, actually, because I think that the origin story for my interest in entrepreneurship is from Bundaberg. So I remember very distinctly being 5 years old. I'd started school and desperately wanting to go to work with my dad on a Saturday. And I decided that I needed to wear my school uniform because uniforms made people official. And so I'd show up in my little normal primary school blue and white striped dress on a Saturday morning with dad. And I had the very official duty, and I'm going to date myself here, of tearing the perforated edges off the computer paper.
Yep.
Yeah. So that was my job, and shredding. And I took it very seriously. And each Saturday morning, felt like hours, it's probably 20 minutes, I would be rewarded with enough money to go and buy a coffee bun, like one of those sort of slice,
yes,
yellow,
yes,
sticky on the top. There was a bakery downstairs. And so I would, that was my reward. And also the privilege of the independence of going down to do it yourself. And every time that I would come back, dad would be on a phone call or he'd be in a meeting. And the door would be open and I'd be really welcome to come in. And I would sit in the corner of the room and enjoy my bakery treat and listen to the conversation that he was having. And at the time, I didn't know that was deliberate, but it absolutely was. It was his way of exposing me to entrepreneurship, to small business, to commerce, so that
what was your dad doing at the time?
Sure. He has built a number plate business. So he is also a guy from Bundaberg who discovered that sheet metal had a higher purpose and set to developing really strong customer-centric relationships with government to create number plates for all of the vehicles that we're driving in Australia. And now, over a 40-year trajectory, he's built that into a business that, together with his business partner, are manufacturing number plates for 100 countries around the world.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's
impressive.
It's just great, those behind-the-scenes stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is a beautiful story of that tipping point, that it was chip away and grow and chip away and grow and chip away and grow, and all of a sudden there is a huge opportunity if you're willing to lean in and grab it. And so I think 30 of the 40 years were growth, but at a much more modest level, and then all of a sudden the leap. Very proud of him.
And going back to those days when you were allowed to come in and do weekend work in your school uniform and get paid in bakery treats. Did you know what your dad was doing? Like, did you know that was an entrepreneurial thing as opposed to just dad goes to work every day?
I suspect that I had an inkling because he was never doing one thing. So he's a really humble guy, and he would talk a lot about the different things that he was trying and all of the things that he was getting wrong. He certainly shielded us from the more severe aspects of where things might have been much closer to the wire than I would have ever realized. But I do recall him being involved in a lot of different things. And I also recall that I was probably about 8 when he joined a business network. He joined YPO. And I do remember that being quite transformative for him, in all of a sudden him being really geared toward learning and really bringing us on that experience. Yeah, so I think I knew, but I wouldn't have known the word. And I suspect that word wouldn't have been used either.
Yeah, I think it was less of a label probably 20, 30 years ago than it is now.
That's true. It's also worth referencing that I think I'm the 5th generation small business owner. So it's not, maybe it would never have been used because it was just part of our family culture and family thread.
I like the definition of small business being manufacturing in 100 countries, but yeah, and as we'll get to Urban List as well, but that's good. Good definition.
So that was your entree into, I guess.
That was my entree. Yeah.
Yeah. And then fast forward a few years, did you stay in Bundaberg?
Yeah, I went to boarding school at 12 and then went on to uni. And the second that I graduated, well before crossing the stage to accept the piece of paper, the second that I graduated, I went overseas. I was so eager to learn a new language, desperate to not be solely an Anglophone. I really wanted to be able to enjoy a new culture and a new place through the lens that comes with that perspective of being able to connect in language. So I do think language is reflective of what I do now. I think it is such a powerful barometer of where culture is at. And so I was really eager. And I remember expressing 3 months before finishing uni to my parents, oh, I'm going to move to Paris. You don't speak French.
I'll figure it out.
I don't know anyone. Yeah, that's true. Where are you going to live? I found an apartment online. And it wasn't the way, this is, I don't know, early 2000s. So finding an apartment online is not what it is today. It
wasn't as easy as Airbnb now.
I don't even know if there were pictures. Anyway, found an apartment. You don't have a job. I'll find one. So I headed off, went to Paris, and then 3 years later went to Los Angeles. So in my 24-year-old wisdom at this point, I finally clocked that if I wanted to work in comms, then perhaps I should be living and working in a place that spoke English.
So well, a version of it anyway.
Yes, brutal. So moved to Los Angeles, and that experience, I think, set me alight for what was to come. So I found myself again in a really big city, twice in pretty quick succession, finding myself in cities where it was really easy to get both literally and figuratively lost. And that was certainly my experience. I was feeling very alone in both places, despite being surrounded by the buzz of the city. And I didn't have close family or friends to orient my way. And my understanding of belonging in big cities is finding those small businesses where you feel like you've found your place and you've found your people. And I turned to the internet to try to uncover that experience for myself in LA. And all I could find were these user-generated ratings and reviews, these big aggregators, directory upon directory, with no one curating the experience down to recommendations that were any good. You were really at the whim of deducing whether you had more in common with the five-star reviewer or the one. And if you're already feeling a sense of disorient or loneliness, the experience of showing up in these places and discovering that they were not for you was like, it started to compound. And so I wanted to create something that could provide you with a sense of belonging. And I was also becoming very interested in social media. So I was working in I had two roles in LA, both formative. One was with a B2B publisher and trade show producer, and they were navigating the very early days of digital publishing, which effectively looked like taking a magazine and creating a PDF of it and putting it online. And it's wild to think this wasn't that long ago. It really wasn't that long ago.
Oh, we're definitely in the midst of Moore's Law, where everything's just accelerating, right?
Oh my gosh, it's wild. And so I was so lucky to be in this place where they were learning how to do this transition and willing to fail fast, and also had the extraordinary privilege of having a boss who shouldn't have been my boss. It's one of those weird scenarios. It's a billion-dollar company, but for whatever reason, the people that were should have been between me and the CEO weren't in their roles at the time, and he took me under his wing as a fourth daughter and exposed me to a whole lot of stuff that I shouldn't have otherwise been. And then I took on a role with a PR agency after that, and they had just acquired a social media company, but that social media company was on the East Coast, and so I put up my very willing hand to be the champion on the West Coast. And so at this point, Facebook doesn't have business pages yet, but you can see that there are small businesses who are using Twitter to attract a client. So there was the Korean taco truck that would tweet the location and his menu each day and started to generate this huge following. You could see the banks actually setting up personal profiles and engaging as a human in a bid to try and integrate themselves into this environment. And I was so curious about what might happen, and also quite terrified about what might happen if small businesses did not have the resource to actually apply and compete in this digital revolution. I was really intrigued by how much seemed to be happening in LA, how little seemed to be happening in Australia, where 90% of our economy is really these sort of butcher baker candlestick maker. And whilst I didn't want to handhold mums and dads through setting up Facebook pages, I did want to make a difference in this space. And whatever I did, I wanted to do it at scale. And so, gosh, long-winded story, but I brought the two ideas together. One was attracting like minds through the internet so that I could provide them with a sense of belonging in the city that they were in. And the other was really channeling those like minds out in support of these small businesses that I loved. So that's what I wanted to do, and is pretty much what Urbanlist does today.
Which we will definitely get to talk about. There were a couple of things that came out of that story for me. One was your willingness to put your hand up and do something immediately. As soon as there was an opportunity, you were like, I'll do it. The other was, and these are common threads we see amongst the entrepreneurs that we work with and have had the opportunity to speak to as part of this podcast. The other was you had a person who took you under their wing and kind of mentored you. And the curiosity element that was a thread through everything that you just described, in addition to whatever you came up with coming out of some sort of problem you had. So you were mentioning it came from a like this inherent loneliness of being in this place and unconnected or disconnected, I should say. Those are some common themes we see, Aaron, Don, that's we see people talk well, about and, all of those things.
And yeah. In the face of doubt of those around you, when they say, you've got no plan, no idea, no experience, whatever else, you just say, what are you talking about? I'm just going to go and sort it out.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. Like I can see the connection of dots to how UrbanList came about. But I'm curious, do you think you could have had a similar experience had you stayed in Australia? Or do you think it was that part of it is that worldly perspective?
I suspect I would have created something, but I'm not sure that it would have been this. Because I think what was interesting to me was that it seemed like an idea that could have universal application. And if it didn't exist in Los Angeles, quite possibly it didn't exist anywhere. So I think there was a certain validation that came from something that I had an idea to do not existing in a place that was really pretty close to the epicenter of what was happening in social and digital.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fascinating because you clearly have these entrepreneurial traits or characteristics. So it's a curious thought to think if you hadn't got on that plane, where would you be now? And what's the other sliding door that would have opened?
Don't you wish we could all do that? I would even get the Gwyneth Paltrow haircut if I could explore those sliding doors.
But I think the sliding door analogy I think is good because a lot of the entrepreneurs I've worked with have this compounding interest journey that occurs and they end up in a business. And some entrepreneurs, their compounding journey, the impulse is there and they're a great entrepreneur and they end up just in a shit market, shit product, just problematic.
Ahead of their time even sometimes.
Could be. Some of them are ahead of their time and some of them are just in shit markets. But it sounds like you were very intentional and I'm listening to what you're saying is the difference sometimes is where people don't have some of those intentions and actually think through things. It's they just go with a wave rather than actually saying, hang on a minute, let's leverage this bit or let's commit to this 100%.
I think both things are true in what you're saying. I think there was an intention. There was not, though, an awareness of an industry that I was entering. And I don't mean I didn't have deep wisdom and knowledge into this industry. I literally didn't know I was creating a media company. I was motivated by the human connection. I was motivated by the idea of creating a groundswell of goodwill within a city. I didn't really know anything about what market it might be or what benchmarks that I might seek. And yet I knew enough to be intentional enough to set goals, to be very clear about what it was that I was seeking to achieve. And that is such a big part of our culture. Now, it's really interesting hearing you replay what you're hearing from my story and identifying words that you're using that sit within our value set, which makes me feel a little bit like a narcissist. And also, yeah, it's really interesting to see how authentic and true the story must be if it's also in how we behave.
Yeah, wow. So you just mentioned you weren't aware that you were building a media company. So I think that's a nice point to jump off on to talk about how UrbanList started and then now and I guess the path from there to now where you do see it as a media company. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, that journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So I came up with the idea in LA. It was 2007. I told a few pretty trusted advisors about this idea, very simple, connecting like minds through the internet and channeling them out in support of the small businesses that I loved. Everybody looked at me with one raised eyebrow because ahead of its time, it wouldn't have been the first mover. It was just there were no business pages for small business. The idea of small business leveraging social media to attract and grow a client base, that conceptually didn't exist. And I didn't have the courage or the confidence to pursue it anyway. And so I put it in the top drawer. I was also feeling very insecure because I'd not really studied anything particularly commercial. And I enrolled myself in the Anderson School, which was the UCLA School of Entrepreneurship. And I did night class. It's like business plan 101. So I built a business plan and recognized that I just couldn't put the idea down. And the tipping point for me was when the idea of looking back and saying, what if, far outweighed the risk of failure. I got on a plane. I did as all self-respecting founders do, moved back in with my parents. And is that a common thread?
Yes. People sleeping on either parents' couches or friends' couches.
Yeah.
I think we're four from four on that.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay. I feel in good company then. Got something right. So I moved home with mum and dad, and Urban List launched from my bedroom in September 2011. Very DIY affair. Me creating content with the intent of orienting people within the city and channeling them in support of small businesses that I loved.
And just to help just listeners at this point, can we a little bit more meat on the what Urban List and does? You've given it that high level, but maybe a bit of a deeper dive.
So it's a digital media company that provides recommendations of experiences to buy, book, do, see, eat, or stream. We do this for 14 cities across Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore. And we provide about 30,000 recommendations an hour to that audience, which is now 3 million people.
And so if I want to do one of those categories of things, I can go to Urban List, and Urban List is curating and helping me find the best things to do under those categories.
That's correct. So what we're really providing is giving you the confidence in the booking and buying choices that you make. I think that consumers, by and large, don't need choice. They want confidence. And that's really the problem that we're looking to solve for them today.
Great.
I love that articulation. Back in 2011, did you have that clarity?
Way.
Yeah.
Way. That came yesterday.
I love it.
Which is always you've got to just experiment and go for a little while in that journey.
You do. And you picked up on something which was a level of intentionality in what I was doing. And I do remember very distinctly, it's me, laptop, pinboard. And I had two post-it notes on the pinboard. And they were the two goals that I wanted to achieve in the first month of launch. And the first was that I wanted 900 people to come to the site. And that was built on the science of how many people do I know and how many of them can I trust to tell one more person. Deep science. And then the other was that I wanted one small business owner to reach out and ask to be featured on the platform. So it didn't need to be a commercial transaction. I just felt that small business owners value their business so highly that if they wanted to align their brand with mine, then I might be onto something. And we did achieve both of those goals, and we actually achieved them in the first 24 hours.
Nice.
Wow. Yes.
I think what I like about that story is, especially in the early stage, founders often don't set little goals like that to work out if they've got product market fit early. They build a product around themselves that they absolutely love, and then the frustration builds because the people or the entities they need to engage. But your two goals answered your two sides of your product market fit requirement. Will people share this? And will a business owner reach out to me? And if the answer had been they didn't do that, my gut feel is your intentionality would have found some other path to go and take.
I probably would have stuck at it for a good 12 months because can be a bit stuck.
Well, I know people have stuck at things for 10 years, so 12 months is actually a good outcome. Okay.
All right.
So you set those primary goals. You worked out you got product market fit. Did you focus on a particular vertical or sector to start with, like food, or did you start with a broad brush?
It was focused enough in that I knew that I was going after it. I needed to go after an audience that existed. And what that looked like to me was, where is their search volume? What are people looking for? So I created content around mid-tail search. I didn't think that there was ever a world that we could compete in best restaurants, but maybe we could compete in best Japanese restaurants. very proud to say that we're number one for best restaurants in pretty much every market. But so
you are my go-to on that. That's for sure.
So I was going after not so much a vertical, but where there was search volume. And then the other thing that I was going after was anecdotal conversations in the cafe, when you'd hear, why is there no good restaurants that are open on a Monday night? And then you would create that piece of content that was great restaurants that are open on a Monday night. And often the content that was performing on search would be meeting that universe, and the content that would really fly on social would be the more anecdotal pieces that were meeting the sort of a need that couldn't really be expressed by internet data. So I, coming back to the origin, it really is like me and a laptop, and I'm trying to figure out how I could grow the thing. And so I was pretty much doing what I said I didn't want to do, which was hand-holding businesses through creating social strategy. And Urbanlist was something of the side hustle, even though in terms of the brain space that it was taking up, it was the main game. And I worked out a strategy that perhaps I could hire people to support me on the social agency side and have a billable hours model, where we could do enough billable hours that I could afford to pay their wage. And then all of the rest of our time we could pour into building Urbanlist. So that's how we were able to run revenue free and without any capital investment for the first 18 months. It was the juggle of billable hours to meet wages. And then after about 18 months, I believe that we had enough credibility and a sufficiently sizable audience that we had something to monetize. And no science, just gut. And so we started to work with small business owners around this idea of, for new businesses, building awareness in the market, for established businesses repositioning to maintain their cultural credibility, and also supporting businesses to grow their social followings and grow their email databases for ongoing marketing return. Ironically, that's what we continue to do today. It's just that our client base is no longer small business. It's now multinational brands. So, go ahead.
Well, you just mentioned that it was small businesses and now multinational brands, but whilst Tribe is generally focused B2B businesses, you're straddling the B2C, which adds that additional complexity that a lot of people we engage with are trying to grapple with. So we'd really appreciate some insights on that journey of how you did the B2C, which bit was more important, which came first. How did you even then migrate to the multinationals out of small business?
It has taken me a really long time to figure out how to do B2C or B2C to B, maybe. I think it's probably more akin to our model. And for the longest time, I could not figure out how we could have a strategy that really met the needs of all of our stakeholders. And we really look at it through the lens of community, clients, and culture, culture being our culture. And so the focus, our model is a flywheel. So we create content that is trusted and credible, that drives an audience, that is high intent and high income earning, that trusts our recommendations and is in market to spend. We connect brands with that audience through content marketing and through shoppable content experiences. And it's all fueled by our people and our culture, who are people that are humble and hungry and have really high EQ and ultimately are very motivated by and really believe in the vision. So it's taken, I'm going to say 10 years to figure out that was our operating system and to figure out that in applying pressure to any of those aspects of the flywheel, they will all spin faster. We are still, we're doing much better than most at managing what is traditionally a church and state model in media between content and advertising. We're doing a job much better than most. And I could argue that we're primed for that, because the only reason a consumer is turning to Urbanlist is because they are seeking a recommendation of something to book, buy, do, see, eat. They're in the market to make a transaction. And so I think that we are perfectly poised to be able to meet the needs of both parties through the nature of the content that we create.
You've referenced culture a lot, and I'd love to come back to that. I think that's a that's something I really love to unpack. But this concept of content, because when I reflect on when I first came across Urbanlist, it was before knowing you, and I do remember it was actually a content piece around finding places to go out on a Monday night, and it actually drove me to Urbanlist. So, but that content piece, is that, can you like talk about that a little bit more? Is that to drive new customers to the site, or is it to get them to essentially, I guess, do business that they wouldn't otherwise do? Like me looking for something, it arrived in my inbox and activated me to do something I wouldn't have otherwise done, but also helped me find Urbanlist, obviously. But are there key actions that you're looking for consumers to take from your content pieces?
The pivotal word there is action. Our content is geared for action, and you will see it. Well, now you'll see it in the headline. It is always how to, where to, why to. There is momentum implicit in the tonality and the way that we create. It is not a browsing experience. It is a high intentional, it's an audience with really high intent, and they are coming to meet a need. What is challenging there is making sure that you are meeting enough of their needs across enough verticals that you can really forge this very deep relationship with your audience and have an ability to really meet brands' needs, our commercial partners' needs, in terms of having sufficient volume across the various categories. We look to what are our traffic sources to try and unpick what is their likely motivation. And what we see is that our audiences that come from search, by and large, spend twice as long on site and view twice as many page views. And what's fascinating about this is that it must be a really strong mix of both new and returning customers, because the reason that they're spending twice as long and going on an exploratory journey is likely because they're less familiar than the return visit from social. And equally, you could argue that, but isn't the search-related visit, aren't they more intentional in what it is that they're looking for because they've punched in something highly specific to land on you to begin with? It's not that you've been surfaced on their commute to work. So we're constantly navigating and developing hypotheses around what they're there for. We also really challenge ourselves to just keep it simple and continue to create content that is really active in meeting our audience's functional need, is really supportive of the culture that we're looking to create. And when I talk about culture, actually external, we believe culture matters. And so we want to be creating content that is motivating our audience and challenging and holding ourselves to account in terms of having a positive cultural impact. And now I'm just
going to stop. On that point, it would be good to loop back to Aaron's question around culture, because you just mentioned you've got external culture that you're cultivating and an internal culture where you have very specific values that you want to have expressed. Can you talk about those two different culture sets, how much they overlap and align?
Sure. So our vision is to be number one for culture seekers who live like it matters.
I love that.
And what this, if you unpack that, it means that we want to attract people who are seeking meaningful experiences over FOMO-filled feeds. We want to attract people who have a level of consciousness that where they invest has impact, not about perfection, but just a level of consciousness. And we want to attract people and businesses and brands who, like us, believe that culture matters and that if you can positively impact culture, you can positively impact the future. So this is really where we're coming from when we look at where to from here and what is it that we continue to create from here. We've got a four-pillar approach to bringing this vision to life. The first is growing the value of Urbanlist, and the second is creating positive impact. Third, make it simple and scalable. And fourth, share the love. So I think implicit in all of that, you can see, if we look at the the importance of culture or culture matters and how each of those pillars plays out in an internal work environment and in an external impact. It's the double entendre is very present for a real reason, and it's because it is the heart and soul of what it is that we're striving to do. There is no way that you can be motivating millions to feel that they both have a sense of belonging within the culture to which they are present and have the ability to impact the way that culture moves and flows for the future. You cannot do that without having an internal team who believe that what they are creating matters and believe in their own voice and believe in the business that is backing their voice to actually be able to positively contribute to culture.
Just a quick pause from today's episode. You probably already know that Tribe Global Ventures is a venture capital firm that invests in Australian and New Zealand high-growth B2B-focused companies that have the US and or the UK on their expansion roadmaps. But we also run events, offsites, and missions that are sometimes open to founders and investors outside of our portfolio companies. Expanding overseas can seem daunting and risky, but not if you hang out with people that do this regularly. We run market entry missions to the US and the UK, and these missions help you gain a deeper understanding of market nuances, help find early customers, and connect you with people that can help with the early operational scale-up phase. We'll also be building lasting relationships with the other participants on each trip and learn from their knowledge and expertise. We also know that being a founder can be a lonely pursuit, and it's easier done when you have a broad tribe to lean on. So we run 1 to 3 day offsites where founders and investors come together to connect in building their companies. Different offsite programs focus on different things like personal performance, business performance, or a combination of both. Go to our website at tribeglobal.vc and subscribe to our tribe community to be kept up to date on all these future events. Okay, now back to today's episode.
How do you as a leader cultivate that culture? And maybe implicit in that question is a broader question around your approach to leadership. I'd love to get your thoughts on, you've led this organization since you found it, how you've approached that over the years.
Sure. So the way that I look at it, I feel like my role is to create an environment where performance and profitability and happiness thrive. I believe that we do that through having a really well articulated and very well understood vision, values that are universally embraced by our team. And there's two components to that. One is who you hire, and the other is to what extent have you really made those values demonstrable through behaviors? So we're really buttoned up on the four behaviors that really underpin each of our values. Strategy, to what extent is where we are investing our resources a reflection of that vision and of those values? And then structure, which has moved and changed so much over time. But when we think about structure, we think about, yes, the structure of the teams and are they well set up to deliver on the strategy, to deliver on the initiatives inherent within, to deliver on the vision. Are we putting them in the driver's seat when it comes to a real understanding of the responsibility that they hold in their role and therefore the opportunity that they hold in their role? And are they able to self-orient the extent to which they are being successful or not? So we're really buttoned up on leading indicators and their ability to access and influence those. We probably a bit heavy in our use of scorecards, if you will, which I think is one of the interesting things about the business. When people look under the hood, they're often intrigued by the level of rigor in terms of metrics and reporting. We are really motivated by access to data and the extent to which we can not inform, influence it. And so all of that is, I think all of that are probably hallmarks of my leadership style. The thing that I have gotten wrong the most times and has been the most catastrophic, and I don't use that lightly, has been my mostly miss and sometimes hit recruitment success. And that's, there's two things that I've gotten wrong there. One is that I have not hired like my life depended on it.
You've been slow to move to make sure you get it right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Thank God that finally clicked for me just pre-COVID, which is a whole other story. So I wasn't hiring like my life depended on it. And I wasn't willing to acknowledge when sometimes the business had outpaced the capability of the team that was currently in place. And so I over-ascribed personal responsibility in being able to meet what was possible. And then that looked like stepping on people's toes or transforming a relationship where once they felt championed to now they were feeling lesser than, which was really not constructive for anyone involved. But all of that probably comes back to varying levels of self-confidence and self-worth and self-belief.
And there's a couple of call-outs I just want to point out in what you've described that I think really aligns with our approach and the patterns that we've seen. You mentioned your role is to create the environment, and often we'll extend that. It's to create the environment where the best outcome is most likely to achieve. And when founders can get that in their mind of that transition point of the doing into creating the environment, I'd like to unpack that with you a little bit. But secondly, there was a sequence of ingredients that you mentioned that often entrepreneurs on the growth journey, they look at other companies to find ideas around vision or structure or that kind of stuff. But you very clearly, you have a structure designed to achieve a strategy, and that strategy is designed to achieve a vision, and you reinforce that with your scorecards and your KPIs. And that sequence becomes really important. And often if people don't have that intention there, they will end up with a structure that isn't designed for a strategy, or they bring a new strategy in and they don't update the structure, or they have goals and scorecards and KPIs that aren't reinforcing behaviors. And if you can put a skewer through that, vision is being achieved by strategy, which is being achieved by structure, which is being reinforced, that's where we see some just amazing results. And I think it sounds like Urbanlist is one of those. So I absolutely commend that approach, but you generally don't start a business that way. There's a transition that gets you into that. So I'd be keen to understand what were those transition points? Where did you feel and learn the need to do that? Just for the listeners to understand, it's probably okay to start nebulous and all over the shop, but if you want true success, you've got to end up in the areas that Susanna's talking about. So, yeah.
I think we had something close to this thinking of approach very early on, but what I didn't have was the right people in the right seats to actually deliver on it. And one of the reasons that I think that we had it in place so early on is not because I'm brilliant, is because I was feeling so under-indexed in terms of my commercial nous, my business nous, that I lent so deeply into sort of knowledge seeking and was so invested in book learning about what other people did to give a more likely perception of success. And my motivation was probably not actually success. My motivation was looking like and feeling like a business that would be successful so that other people might give me a pat on the head and tell me that I was doing a good job. So it was in place early, but not because I'm brilliant, but because I was not feeling confident. And so I was looking for structures. I was looking for where in the world does the future already exist? And how can I apply that future to my business and add my 10%? It was not, though, until I was introduced to a Patrick Lencioni model of ideal team player that has just stood me in such good stead since. It's this Venn diagram of humble, hungry, and people smart, and that you need people where all three of those spheres overlap and you can punch a hole through the middle. That is your ideal team players. And so that's now what I seek. And universally, when I look back on mishires, I can see where we were not the right fit for them nor were they the right fit for us because one of those circles was not present in their profile. I can talk about that for 40 minutes if I want, but I really encourage people to.
But you've adopted some frameworks. You've had some pain. Mm. You've experienced some stuff, and then your search for knowledge, irrelevant of why that impulse was there, has led to some frameworks that you can now filter things through. And that's great.
And I think that you made the comment, Suze, around it was because you were lacking in confidence. But I think that's an important another way to frame that, or another way to think about it, was that you had the self-awareness to know that wasn't necessarily a strength that you possessed right now, and you needed to bolster that around you. I think from what we see, that's what a lot of great entrepreneurs do, is are very self-aware and humble about where their strengths lie and where their weaknesses are. And yes, absolutely, they could spend ages trying to bolster their weaknesses, or they can bolster their team to complement their own strengths and make sure they fill those gaps.
Heard a great line recently. Yes, you can teach a dog to climb a tree, but you should probably hire a squirrel.
That's awesome.
That is a great line.
I think one of the things that differentiates UrbanList is the fact that you've got such a high level of diversity at almost every level in your business. And with the conversation around culture and your leadership style, how much do you think that reflects your leadership style? How much is that? Why do you think that is the case? And how have you found that to be effective for UrbanList, if at all?
It is all relative. So from the outside, we probably look that way. And internally, there is intense pressure on me from the team that we need to be more diverse and we need to be looking more actively for who is not applying for roles and why. And I think that is by virtue of the culture that we've forged, and that if you're willing to stand for something, you've also got to be willing to fall for something. And so there's a level of scrutiny on us, on me, from the team, which I love. Really, all of us taking on that accountability to make sure that there is true diversity. We're a 100% female leadership team at the moment, 100% female exec, which is not by design. And is something that's never really been a thing until maybe you look to apply for some awards and somebody sees that as shiny. But it is a group of people that I am so privileged and so grateful to be working with. The thing that I'm probably the most proud of is we have made a real commitment in the content that we're creating to make sure that there is a plurality of perspectives being shared. So I went to a presentation from Sinead Burke, who is a disability advocate, she's Irish, and she was talking about the impact of design and design culture on accessibility, and how really looking at meeting accessibility needs can be the greatest unlocker of creativity, and not looking at it as regulation, but rather looking at it as the lever for differentiation. And I was really inspired by that presentation. And from that, we did one very little thing that's become a very big thing. So from there, I recognized that Instagram was the fastest growing social platform and inherently exclusionary because it was only accessible for those that could see. And so we did something very simple. We continued to have a presence on Instagram, and we continued to have captions that were witty and of our tone. And then we had an image description below that screen readers could actually read. We got so much gratitude from our community for taking that leap. And now there is alt text on Instagram. I don't know if I can take any credit for that, but it has happened. And we were the first media company to acknowledge that it was a challenge. We then recognized that we needed to be dedicating 10% of our voice share to underrepresented voices. And we do that through the creators that we engage and the talent that we showcase and the themes that we cover. And very importantly, we don't charge those people with doing the heavy lift, but we are very consultative in making sure that what we're doing really does meet the needs of community. Nothing about us without us. And we pay them just awesome. As everybody should.
Listeners of this podcast will know that we like to shout out to our portfolio because you may be their customers and, well, we're shameless pluggers. We're proud to be invested in Apply ID. You need Apply ID if you're undertaking identity and anti-money laundering checks for any reason. Accountants, lawyers, real estate agents, and finance companies trust ApplyD because of their easy-to-use platform that can be used on an individual check basis, or their API integration can seamlessly embed into your company's workflow. Ultimately, it's about reducing all the time you waste doing this compliance task and helping you to convert more customers through a great customer experience. Visit applyid.com. That's applyid.com.
A follow-up question I have with that, and feel free to not answer this, but a lot of companies will say, you said our leadership team are 100% female. I'm sure there's other elements of diversity in that team apart from gender. You said it wasn't a big deal, but it seems to be a big deal for other companies. They don't seem to be able to achieve anything close to parity even. You're a media company, but you're also a technology company. You in many ways look no different, or should look no different than any other company in this space. Why do you think it is so difficult for other companies to have a similar level of representation and to do the sorts of things that you just described in terms of making their platforms more accessible and less exclusionary?
I'm just trying to figure out, like, why is it so easy for us and so hard for others? I think there is an aspect of it's easier to be what you can see. I am a single mother. I have two beautiful children with whom I share custody with my former partner, who's also a wonderful human. And I have built a business whilst having children, have shown that it is possible to be a very committed and present mother and grow a business in 14 markets and have a level of presence with teams and with customers in those markets. And it is Tetris. It is really hard. But I have found my way through to do that. And I really challenge the people in our business, and dominantly I'm challenging women on this, but that needn't necessarily be the case. I really challenge the narratives and the stories that we tell ourselves around what is possible. And I challenge the narratives around what they perceive that I will do, accommodate, afford, make possible. I really challenge them to ask for what it is that might make it more possible for them to lean in to doing their roles or to growth to its fullest potential. I don't necessarily know the answers of what they might need, nor do I think it's necessarily my responsibility to serve it on a platter. I want to be challenged for what I am not doing. I want an opportunity to meet the mark for what might be more possible. And a big part of my role is often coaching around these narratives and stories that make it feel less possible for us to do pretty extraordinary things.
And I think also the framework that you've chosen to help you filter for people, words like humble and hungry, they transcend a whole lot of things. And I would just get the feeling that if you're using that kind of framework, you've got a much broader approach to who is going to come in and fit in that to some traditional ones that are actually like experience or whatever else. I think you've got that as well.
It's less bias.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I think of you, Susanna, I think of your value system, just you embody it. But the other thing is I've never seen you stressed. And you talk about being
he is remarkably calm.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about being a single parent while doing all of this. Like, are you just a magical unicorn of stress-free existence? Or where do you go to? How do you manage yourself through all of that?
It's not that I am not stressed, but I did grow up in a family environment where we weren't super expressive with emotion. And it has been a learned experience to recognize that the sharing of feeling is actually the greatest connector. So part of what might appear swan-like is literally just baked in
repressioning.
All that said, though, I have a coach who has been extraordinary in terms of shaping a new way of thinking and therefore a new way of feeling. There is very little now that I encounter that I would actually ascribe the word problem to. It feels like it more is a scenario that is. And she's really supported me to to recognize the inherent paradox of life, that you can be both strong and sad at the same time, that you can be both flexible and focused at the same time. And she's also really encouraged me to fall in love with possibility. So inherent in everything is that lens of possibility. So what once might have been a problem, I now get much more curious about. I also practice Vedic meditation. So on a more like practical and tangible side, that has been really fascinating as a journey. I'm a bit of a data geek. I wear an Aura ring. They are not a brand partner, but I wear an Aura ring. And when I am being quite religious about my commitment to the meditation, and when I tip over 30 minutes a day, so when I'm more in the 40-minute realm, my biometrics on the Aura in the workday like are wild. It gives you little green bars that shows really when you're in restorative state, and most of my workday is green.
Do you feel that too? So like I think that's a really interesting way to get immediate feedback to be a reinforcer for some positive behaviors. I wonder if you weren't wearing that, would you still feel it?
Oh, there's definitely an element of gamification.
Well, whatever works, right?
But if it works, exactly.
Yeah, no, but it's more like it's great to get that because it does give you that immediate feedback. Okay, this is working.
Yeah.
But you want it to translate to how
you feel it in the pace with which I can apply myself to a task that is truly deep thinking and very important, and the rapidity with which I can turn out that task and that thinking. That has been revolutionary, severing the correlation between time and important, that sense that in order to do the deep and important thinking, you must take yourself off the grid and have this space. I found a way of creating clarity and space within and through, and that's been a real game changer. And I think that is one of the things that makes my life possible, in that I can really quickly move between spaces, show up as very present, and not feed into this story that I need to pull myself away for extended periods of time to do the thinking that's necessary.
That's really powerful.
Such a discipline.
I loved your articulation. There's a little nuance in there that I absolutely loved, which was finding a different way to think, which created a different way of feeling. And that causality, which many of us in different moments get that causality the wrong way around. The feeling creates the thought rather than emotional regulation. But I love the way you articulate it. That's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, my coach's name's Anna Reynolds. And if anyone's a little stuck as to where they're at the moment, she was transformative for me.
One of the things you said in your answer before, Susanna, was that you're a data geek. Mm-hmm. But I also know you're very creative, and you talked a bit about your dad earlier as an entrepreneur, but I know there's one half of your family which is also incredibly creative. Can you maybe talk a little bit about where that strong love of creativity, and which does express in many ways in you, but you have a love of the arts as well. You're on the board of Queensland Ballet. Can you maybe talk about how that fits into your, or is important to your entrepreneurship path, mm-hmm. where you think that comes from, and what the having this data driven side of you, but also this incredibly creative side of you, what advantage you think that might bring?
So the first thing that I need to reveal is that my heart is racing, because for the longest time I would have perceived being highly creative as an insult. And the reason for that is that I saw it as the opposite end of the spectrum, as being commercial. And I, so case in point, like really invested in reading all of the books that I could read about how to create these structures that might make me more commercial, because I was just creative. So yeah, I'm really aware of what you pointed out, Aaron, that shift in the thinking and the feeling, and watching them flip over one another in myself as you were asking the question. So
you still see it as an insult though?
Or no, of course. No, I don't anymore. Nor do I see it as mutually exclusive. I think that creativity is a thing that flows through in every interaction that we have in the day. And I really don't ascribe to the idea that some people are and some people are not. I think that's a belief system that either they or we hold. So on creativity, I don't know how I don't apply it to my work. It is something that I probably don't hold value or identify where it's showing up because it is so much part of who I am. This is the worst answer ever. I just simply don't know how to answer this question. I don't really have frameworks in which I try to unlock or unleash my creativity or others, other than to say that we do use HBDI within the business, which is a thinking style. It's a model of thinking styles. And it's not about strengths or weaknesses, but it's where we go to when we think about an issue or an opportunity. And I index very high yellow, which is strategy, ideas, future, and high red, which is relationships and people and the impact that these ideas and strategies might have on people. I index very high in those spaces and domains, equally under pressure. So if you think about your profile dipping in and out of four quadrants, one being ideas, strategy, one being data and facts, one being process, and one being people, I have a string that connects all four. I think most CEOs do. What happens though, it's not an elastic band, it is a piece of string, and under pressure, I will not let go of the strategy or the vision. I will not let go of the care and concern for the people and the impact it's going to have. But what I pull out of is data. I pull out of data and go into detail and process and get my hands very dirty and very busy showing how it can be done. So that's that stubborn.
You revert to gut and
yeah,
will.
It's not. I think that's probably what you were identifying at play. It is the creativity of ideation and strategy and future, and in general life, I hold data as being an orienting source. But wow, when push comes to shove, I'm pretty willing to put it aside and just show you how you can do it anyway. And that's not all that helpful. That's when you start to step on toes. That's when people start to get confused because you're not usually playing in my lane. What are you doing here? Could you please get back up there in the yellow?
But I think like your role on the board of the Queensland Ballet, that will be reflective of not just your deep love and understanding of ballet, but also your ability to bring those commercial elements to that sphere as well.
Yeah, I think I've found a confidence now in that being my superpower, this ability to appeal to some of the social needs of us as humans and meet that in a way that actually holds commercial benefit and appeal too. So an example of that in play is this sense of belonging that is what our content creates, that sense of belonging. And that's actually what I look at when I'm trying to figure out how do we continue to have a business in a world that is potentially led by generative AI, where what role should we be playing? What role will we continue to play? Why would people turn to us? And I think for as long as AI is generative in nature, it will not be able to meet that sense of belonging that community provides. So what I'm really curious about within the arts, and one of the reasons that I'm so interested in this role with Queensland Ballet, is that I actually think that one of the great barriers to entry for the arts is that we haven't found a way to create a sense of belonging for a wider audience that is inherently exclusionary in that we feel there is something that we don't know or don't understand. We're not all that willing to give over a night and money to see ourselves in an experience where we feel lesser than and dumb. And that's the bridge that I'd really love to cross and the legacy that I'd like to leave in that role, to find a way that this wonderful ballet company can create a sense of belonging and really enlighten people on the stories that are being told on that stage, because it's not that complicated. When you go to the ballet, you are seeing the athleticism and the creativity and the performance of the book you've read and the film that you've seen by another name.
Yeah, wonderful. I like asking entrepreneurs who have been the most influential people in their lives.
Ooh, my parents, they are both interested and interesting, and they are my hallmark. I think that's how you stay young. They are so interested in people, in the world, in learning. And
they're
so an incredibly collaborative partnership. 40 years in, and they choose to travel incessantly together.
Which is wonderful.
That, I think that's really remarkable.
Impressive.
So I'm fascinated by that and the extent to which they continue to lean into their learning. You would never see Dad showing up at a Harvard Business School workshop that was happening in Brisbane without Mum going as well. It would never occur to them that she wouldn't go. It would never occur to them to not invite. It's not because she works in a commercial world. It's because they are so interested. And by virtue of that, they're interesting people. I would also say my children, because they have really highlighted for me the importance of not personalizing situations and bringing your own shit into the dynamic. I am not as triggered as I am by anyone as I am by my children. I am so triggered. And it is, of course, because in scenarios, I am looking at it through that deficit model of like, what have I not done? Or what will people think of? And that is the last thing that they need in that scenario. And so finding my way through to being truly present with what it is that they're experiencing in that moment. And that's been so broadly applicable and really deepen the relationships and the impact that I have outside of that world. And then the other person, there's many wonderful mentors that I've had along the way that have championed me well ahead of what I deserved at that time. One was Joe Loja, who was the CEO of Advanstar, who took me under his wing. One was Mark Sowerby, who really championed me and showed me what it meant to be on a board and introduced me to you, Elaine. So I'm so grateful for the role that he has played in championing me and guiding me and giving me well more time than I probably deserved. And I would also say Anna Reynolds, who's my coach. She has been transformative and has, yeah, really changed what I will be. I now can really say hand on heart that I trust myself and I live bravely and, yeah, I've fallen in love with possibility.
And on that note, what is next for Urbanlist in terms of that falling in love with possibility? And are you still excited about it?
I'm so excited about it.
Mentor says that entrepreneurs have a kind of a burnout time frame, but
I know.
Sounds like you're still
wrong.
Yeah.
Well, it's wrong for me anyway. He doesn't get much wrong with that one. So it has taken me a long time to recognize that the holdback for me has been a willingness to actually speak my dreams. This has always been a dream, and yet, oh my God, again, heart race. So this has always been a dream, but it has taken me until this year to say it out loud, which is that I want Urbanlist to be an internationally recognized, used, love brand that is both influencing and being influenced by culture all around the world. I really want it to be number one globally for culture seekers who live like it matters.
And that's not only
so simple. Like, why can't I just enunciate that? Because it's all of those feelings of lesser than, or if I say that, people just, I don't know, be doubters, and then that's all I'll need to not do it. So I'm very excited by the opportunity to scale into new markets and really curious about the fact that what got us here won't get us there. What is our go-to-market approach? Do we go deep in one? Do we go broad across many? How do I learn about the idea of accepting resourcing that might not just be profitable revenue? And free cash flow? And what sort of leader do I need to become in order to facilitate all of this? So I'm very excited by what is to come, and even more excited that actually the building blocks of who we are and what we stand for does not need to change. It's actually bang on for where we need to go.
Yeah, you've built the right foundations and now it's ready to scale. And it is exciting. I'm excited for you.
Oh, thanks, Lane.
I love that your heart still flutters with the excitement as you even talk about it.
It really does. It really, how lucky am I? I'm almost 12 years in, and at points I have fallen out of love, but that's been directly correlated to my belief in whether I was the right person to lead and grow, when I ceased to believe that I was the right person to lead and grow, the love was lost. And when I started to believe that indeed I could be, that's where it gets reignited.
What a great point to end on, self-belief.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we'll put all of the details about Urbanlist in the show notes. So everyone who ever wants a recommendation for anything amazing and culturally aligned with them can find it if they don't already know about Urbanlist. But Susanna, thank you for taking the time this morning. I know you had to shift your day around in Sydney to fit us in, so we very much appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. I've absolutely loved it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susanna.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode. Don't forget to head over to the website tribeglobal.vc and register for our tribe community to keep up to date with events as they come out. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a rating to help us get this out to other founders.